and welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
And I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 198th episode of the Nauticast, titled The Wolf and the Hound, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, Arya 9 and 10, in which Arya and her new best friend, Sandor Clegane, take a road trip through the rain to the Twins. And you thought Catelyn's trip was depressing.
I don't know, man. A little girl and her dog always makes for some wholesome adventuring.
I'm just imagining like the Indiana Jones music playing as they stride off together, just ba-ba-ba-ba, off into the sunset.
We named the dog Arya.
Exactly. That's the big reveal waiting for us at the end of A Storm of Swords. So our spoiler warning, as always, prepare to be spoiled for the 5 novels, the 3 Duncan Egg novellas, histories, interviews, the Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows, anything and everything. Our question this episode comes from our patron, The Grandest Maester, who asks, do you think Arya and Sandor will have a farewell like they did in the show? So, talking about Arya and Sandor's second farewell, not their first farewell, their fake-out farewell at the end of A Storm of Swords, where she leaves him for dead, but talking about the second kind of parting scene they have in the show towards the very end, towards the end of Season 8, when they both go to King's Landing but for revenge, but Sandor turns her back. Do you think we'll get a scene like that, or do you think the plot threads are going to take them in different enough directions that might not go down?
I want to say no. I just feel like I really want Sandor, first of all, not to really come back into the narrative. Maybe he's there and someone stumbles upon him later on, but I really don't want him to be a major part. If he does end up being a major part, I see him maybe being involved more with what's going on with the Fate and his brother. It's just one of those things where there's so many ways it can go, and we've had 12 years to consider every possibility. You know, I've fought every battle in my mind everywhere, as Littlefinger said on the show. So, like, there's definitely a chance, and especially if he's in the Riverlands and we think Arya's going to come through the Riverlands, it's just a hop across the Narrow Sea from Braavos whenever she ends up coming back. I still think she's going north. I know we talked about this a couple episodes ago, that she might come back with Justin Massey. But it's just one of those things where thematically and narratively, I could see her showing up, you know, in the Riverlands, in King's Landing, in the north, because she has enemies everywhere and she has things she can do or people she can see or reunite with, including
people
her,
to kill,
including exactly. her direwolf Nymeria, who's in the Riverlands. So there's a lot of things in the Riverlands for her to do. It just becomes one of those questions of how much time do we have and where are these other moving pieces going to be. So my tendency is to say no, but I'm not like ruling it out.
Yeah, I think the show winnowed things down in a way that it could produce moments like that, that the characters might just be too far flung or busy for, or just be, you know, have different aims in the books. I do think Arya returning to the Riverlands somehow temporarily does make sense, if for no other reason than, as you said, Nymeria is there. She has to reunite with the Wolfpack at some point. But, you know, there's nothing really stopping Nymeria from going north, I guess, if she can make her way through the swamp, if Hal and Reed helps out. So Arya could easily reunite with her Wolfpack there. That's not necessarily a way for her to reunite with Sandor. But I do think George probably wants Sandor back in the game to some capacity. He's keeping him on ice, I think, on the Quiet Isle for a reason. And you do need a POV, because, of course, Sandor is not a POV, so you can't do it from his own perspective. So Arya is one of the less awkward ones you can put in that position. Brienne, I think, would be the other one. I think if Brienne sticks around the Riverlands for a while before moving north or to King's Landing or wherever her goal is next, she could also run across Sandor Clegane. Although, I guess she already has at the Quiet Isle. And that would be funny also if she didn't know who he was at first, although he'd have to be hiding his face for quite a while, because as Arya thinks to herself in these chapters, Sandor can't really hide his face once you see it. You pretty much immediately know who he is. So I think either one of those could serve as the vessel, but I don't think they're, because in part they didn't have as extended relationship in the books as they do in the show, I don't think their arcs will climax because of that moment with each other. I think that's it could still happen in the books, but I think it's less likely. So thank you to the Grandest Maester for the question. If you'd like to ask us questions, we are forced to answer here on the Nauticast podcast. You can head on over to patreon.com/nauticastasoiaf, where our patrons get benefits, including early access to our episodes, exclusive episodes every month, and the right to force us to answer your questions. So check that out if you haven't already. And just a little housekeeping for the next couple episodes coming up. We're in the midst of Red Wedding Month here on the Nauticast, where we're doing the Red Wedding chapters as a few few episodes in a row. So we're covering Arya 9 and 10 in this episode, in which Arya heads north to the Twins with Sandor. Next up, we're going to be doing A Storm of Swords, Catelyn 6, in which Catelyn and Robb and his army show up at the Twins. And then for our big 200 episode spectacular, our big anniversary, we are doing The Red Wedding itself. What better way to celebrate a big round number than with The Red Wedding? So that'll be Catelyn 7, the inside part of The Red Wedding, and Arya 11, the outside part. We're going to do that together as one episode towards the end of the month.
The takes will flow.
The takes will flow. The red will run. So let's kick that off with A Storm of Swords, Arya 9 and 10, and let's jump right into the synopsis. Right as we tune in, Sandor Clegane is swearing loudly. Yeah, seems about right. It's hard to imagine anything more in character than that. What's he swearing about? The sight of a river he and Arya have to cross. Only who knows how the hell they're going to do that when the water has risen so high thanks to the rain that the trees themselves are drowning in. Arya, stuck in the saddle with the hound's huge gym-toned muscles keeping her in place, just wants to know if this river is the Blackwater. They've come so far in the dark that she's completely lost track of where they are.
It's a river we need to cross. That's all you need to know.
Clegane would answer her from time to time, but he had warned her not to talk back. He had given her a lot of warnings that first day.
Next time you hit me, I'll tie your hands behind your back, he'd said. The next time you try and run off, I'll bind your feet together. Scream or shout or bite me again, and I'll gag you. We can ride double, or I can throw you across the back of a horse, trussed up like a sow for slaughter. Your choice.
Unsurprisingly, Arya had chosen to ride double. But, even more unsurprisingly, she took advantage of the first time they made camp to try and smash Sandor's head in with a rock. Oh, I'm sorry, his ugly head, she specifies. Ah, what a brat. I love her. But Arya got caught, Sandor took the rock away, and all she could do was kick him with her tiny orphan feet.
I'll give you that one, he said when he flung the rock into the bushes. But if you're stupid enough to try again, I'll hurt you.
Why don't you just kill me like you did Micah?
Arya had screamed at him. She was still defiant then, more angry than scared. He answered by grabbing the front of her tunic and yanking her within an inch of his burned face.
The next time you say that name, I'll beat you so bad, you'll wish I killed you.
Sandor Clegane, everyone, lord and master of unresolved issues. Back in the present, Arya is pretty sure the river has to be the Blackwater, even though it doesn't look like how she remembers it. After all, Sandor serves the Lannisters, so he must be dragging her back to King's Landing to face Joffrey and Cersei, right? Cut Arya some slack, she didn't read Sansa's chapters in A Clash of Kings. Sandor is stumped in terms of how to find a way across, which is great news as far as Arya is concerned. She's hoping Beric and the Brotherhood will catch up to them. Then again, Sandor has been working hard to throw off any pursuit, and when Arya started scratching her name into tree trunks while taking a leak, Sandor quickly caught her and became her bathroom babysitter henceforth. Just imagining someone stumbling across one of those trees later and finding, like, Arya plus Gendry and a little heart. Sandor says they'll head for Lord Harroway's town. Surely the noble, valiant Lord Harroway will help our heroes? Nah, the Harroways are long since dead and gone, and Lord Root runs the town. Sandor says he's got Old King Andahar's two-headed water horse. Whoever the hell Old King Andahar is, too many different people running this place. You guys gotta get your shit together. Arya's got the same questions I do, but she knows better than to ask them. She's just glad to stop riding face first into the rain. It washes down her cheeks like tears, and hey, wolves never cry. Only when they watch sad movies. Sad wolf movies, A Wolf to Remember, things of that nature. It's a miserable ride. Dark and wet and cold. Arya is sore all over, and she's got a pretty bad fever, but Sandor Clegane, also Lord and Master of Bedside Manor, tells her to wipe her little nose and shut up. When he's not growling at her canine style, he sleeps in the saddle, trusting his huge black horse to follow the path. Sandor calls him Stranger, and he's as deadly as the name. Arya tries to ride off with him once while Sandor was taking a piss, but Stranger nearly bit her face off. But he'd get along so well with Rorge and Biter. See, this is why I don't mess with horses. Apologies to Girls Gone Canon. Finally, they arrive at Lord Harroway's town, only for Sandor to once more start dropping the SH bomb, by which of course I mean Seven Hells. Just like the trees earlier, the town is drowned under the rising river water. Only the larger buildings are poking above water. All the rest is reduced to a forest of chimneys, as George writes. The chimney sweep song from Mary Poppins would probably be a lot less fun if there was just water rising from the bottom of the screen like a video game. Thankfully, there is still smoke rising from a tower in the town, and Arya spies the two-headed horse, which turns out to be just a big old boat with carved wooden horse heads on both bow and stern. That's too bad. I was looking forward to a literal two-headed horse, although that implies the existence of a horse with no heads and two butts. God's most unfortunate creature. Eo, you can be Lisa's. Sandor shouts out and several men emerge on the boat. Sandor requests passage, please, and offers to pay for it. Arya wonders how he'll do that, since Beric took all his gold. Aw, Arya. Everything she's been through and seen and done, and sometimes she still just, like, break the rules? You really think someone would do that? A half dozen more guys pop up and start getting the boat ready for transit. Sandor rides a stranger down the hill and up the gangplank where the guy in charge of the boat awaits them. "Wet enough for you, sir?" he asked, smiling. The hound's mouth gave a twitch.
"I need your boat, not your bloody wit."
"To be fair to Sandor, I'm also less than fond of hot enough for you guys. Banish them all to the Seven Hells, we'll see how hot it is for them then." The ferryman demands 3 gold dragons to cross the river. Sandor bitches about inflation and the gold standard and the Westerosi Federal Reserve for a while, but the ferryman isn't haggling, not with the river running this high. Sandor offers to pay, on the other side, of course. The ferryman refuses at first, but when Sandor instead offers steel, aka his sword in the guy's face, the ferryman starts seeing things his way. Ah, violence, the oldest currency there is. "How do I know you're good for it?" the bent-backed man asked, after a moment. "He's not," she wanted to shout. Instead, she bit her lip.
"Knight's honor,"
the hound said, unsmiling.
"He's not even a knight." She did not say that either.
Oh well, we always have room for a not-a-knight here on the Nauticast. Speaking of false identities, the ferryman refers to Arya as Sandor's son, while going over the logistics, and Arya flips out at the idea of being the Hound Jr. "It's not so bad, Arya. The kids can call you Hoju." Speaking of Homer and Bart, Sandor casually strangles Arya for daring to talk back before telling her to get inside the hut and get warm and dry. Which she does for, like, 2 seconds, before sneaking back out to see the boat get underway. She wouldn't be Arya underfoot if she didn't. The two-headed horse eased slowly through the shallows, picking its way between the chimneys and rooftops of drowned Harroway. A dozen men labored at the oars, while 4 more used the long poles to push off whenever they came too close to a rock, a tree, or a sunken house. The bent-backed man had the rudder. Rain pattered against the smooth planks of the deck and splashed off the tall, carved horse heads fore and aft. Arya was getting soaked again, but she didn't care. She wanted to see. The man with the crossbow still stood in the window of the round tower, she saw. His eyes followed her as the ferry slid by underneath. She wondered if he was this Lord Root that the hound had mentioned. He doesn't look much like a lord. But then she didn't look much like a lady either. Hey, and Sandor doesn't look like a knight. You should all get along, be best friends, create, like, I don't know, a brotherhood or something like that. We'll workshop it. Once they get into the river proper, the current starts taking hold, and it's all the oarsmen can do to keep them moving toward the landing on the other side. Arya considers jumping over the side and swimming away to escape Sandor. The kid is much braver than I am. She realizes she might drown, but she thinks that might be better than going back to King's Landing. Oh, forget the courage, that's just sad. Don't worry, Arya, you're not going to King's Landing. You're going to the Twins for your uncle's wedding. Oh, right. Yeah, go ahead. Jump in. Before she can, though, the ferryman shout, "Iceberg, dead ahead!" No, if only. At least Iceberg stay still. Instead, Arya sees a huge uprooted tree coming their way. The oarsmen try to steer away, but it won't be enough. Thankfully, 2 of the men on deck manage to divert it with their poles. Less thankfully, one of them goes overboard in the process, the water swallowing him up so fast that there's no time to even try and rescue him. And with that, Arya's dreams of a quick watery death vanish. At least for now. When they finally reach the other side, the ferryman demands 6 dragons instead of 3. Might seem ethically shady, but he did lose a guy, and anyway, it's squeaky clean compared to what Sandor does, which is offered 10 dragons in the form of his paper IOU from Beric, which is good for about 9,000 dragons. Sandor says he'll be back someday for his change. Oh man, there better be a whole book just about that. The interest rates and dealing with inflation. I can't wait for the release of A Flock of Fiduciaries coming soon to a radically downsized bookstore near you. The ferryman protests that Sandor promised gold on his knight's honor, but Sandor says that knights have no honor, take a shot everyone, and rides off as they hurl curses and rocks, neither of which mean anything to him. He wasn't just being a lying asshole, as he tells Arya. He was making sure that the ferryman won't trust Beric as easily, thus preventing any chance of rescue for Arya. Arya huddled down and held her tongue.
Falor Morghulis, she thought sullenly. Sir Ilyn, Sir Meryn, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei, Dunsan, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, Sir Gregor and the Tickler, and the Hound, the Hound, the Hound.
Wow, 3 deaths for Sandor. That's impressive. That's like the EGOT of dying. Arya's cold gets bad enough that even Sandor briefly gives a shit. though all his attempts to make a fire fail miserably. Sandor and Fire, you know, they just don't get along. They're the ultimate odd couple. The Hound sliced the meat with his dagger, and narrowed his eyes when he caught Arya looking at the knife.
Don't even think about it.
I wasn't, she lied. He snorted to show what he thought of that, but he gave her a thick slice of sausage. Arya worried it with her teeth, watching him all the while.
I never beat your sister, the Hound said, but I'll beat you if you make me. Stop trying to think up ways to kill me. None of it will do you a bit of good.
Wow. Dude, no one even mentioned Sansa. She just lives rent-free in Sandor's head. Sandor does give Arya credit for looking right at his face, unlike her sister. She calls him ugly, but that just rolls right off Sandor by now. Instead, he points out that if she really did get away, she might get caught by someone worse. Arya says there is no one worse, only for Sandor to remind her that he's not even the worst Clegane. Gregor once killed a man for snoring. Arya brags that she does so know the Mountain. Maybe brags is the wrong word there, and she also knows his men, rattling off the names she's kept memorized for her kill list. Turns out that's a good memorization technique. Maybe we all need a kill list. Anyway, Sandor is shocked that Arya knows Gregor's men so well. She tells him about being taken captive with her friends back in Book 2, and Sandor, true to form, finds that hideous story the funniest thing ever. To be fair, it is pretty funny that Gregor never realized he had such a valuable prisoner. Maybe Arya could see the humor in it easier if it weren't for, you know, all the torture. Tragedy plus time equals comedy, as they say. Sandor says he'll throw that joke in Gregor's face before killing him. He's talked about that before, and Arya is confused. Why would you kill your brother? I don't know, Arya. Maybe take another look at Sandor's face. There might be a clue hidden somewhere in there.
Didn't you ever have a brother you wanted to kill?
He laughed again. Or maybe a sister? He must have seen something in her face then, for he leaned closer.
Sansa. That's it, isn't it? The wolf bitch wants to kill the pretty bird.
No, Arya spat back at him. I'd like to kill you. Methinks the little lady doth protest too much. Sandor knows that Arya hates him for chopping Micah into tiny bite-sized pieces, but hey, on the other hand, he saved Sansa's life during the riot, and as we all know, a good act washes out the bad. What, is that not how the line goes? Nah, I'm pretty sure it is. Sandor also mentions Sansa singing him a song. Arya says he's lying, which, no, not really, he's just conveniently leaving out the part where he had a knife to her throat all the time. But Sandor is telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about where they're going, and it's not King's Landing after all.
Bugger Joffrey, bugger the Queen, and bugger that twisted little gargoyle she calls her brother. I'm done with their city, done with their Kingsguard, done with Lannisters. What's a dog to do with lions, I ask you?
He reached for his waterskin, took a long pull, and as he wiped his mouth, he offered the skin to Arya and said,
The river was the Trident, girl. The Trident, not the Blackwater. Make the map in your head if you can. On the morrow we should reach the King's Road. We'll make good time after that, straight up to the Twins. It's going to be me who hands you over to that mother of yours. Not the noble lightning lord or that flaming fraud of a priest. The monster.
He grinned at the look on her face.
You think your outlaw friends are the only ones can smell a ransom? Dondarrion took my gold, so I took you. You're worth twice what they stole from me, I'd say. Maybe even more, if I sold you back to the Lannisters like you fear. But I won't. Even a dog gets tired of being kicked. If this young wolf has the wits the gods gave a toad, he'll make me a lordling and beg me to enter his service. He needs me, though he may not know it yet. Maybe I'll even kill Gregor for him, he'd like that.
He'll never take you, she spat back. Not you.
Then I'll take as much gold as I can carry, laugh in his face, and ride off. If he doesn't take me, he'd be wise to kill me. But he won't. Too much his father's son, from what I hear. Fine with me. Either way, I win. And so do you, she-wolf, so stop whimpering and snapping at me. I'm sick of it. Keep your mouth shut, and do as I tell you. And maybe we'll even be in time for your uncle's bloody wedding.
Some unspecified amount of time later, they're riding a wagon full of salt pork and pig's feet toward the Twins. What wagon? Where did all this pork come from? Don't worry, we'll get to that. As Frey outriders come riding toward them, Sandor once again tells Arya to sit down and shut up. He ought to get like a coffee mug with that printed on it, would save him a bunch of time. Sandor has stripped both Stranger and himself of their fancy accoutrements, disguising himself as a simple farmer. Pretty fucking big farmer, though, as Arya thinks, and he has to keep his face down and his hood up to hide those burns. The outriders arrive, led by a knight with a pitchfork sigil. Arya had considered revealing herself to the first riders they came across, but only if they turned out to be Stark men, or at least Umber or Glover or some other house she recognized. She's never seen the pitchfork sigil before. Guess Arya should have been there for the Night of the Laughing Tree story.
You have business at the Twins? The knight asked.
Salt pork for the wedding feast, if it please you, sir.
The hound mumbled his reply, his eyes down, his face hidden.
Salt pork never pleases me.
Speak for yourself, sir. We need Gimli to show up and teach this guy a thing or two about the beauty of the salted cured meats. The knight barely spares a glance for Sandor, and none at all for Arya. He's focused on Stranger, who is way too big and strong to pass for a plow mount. Sandor has to pass off the horse as a wedding gift from Lady Went. Did I say gift? I meant bribe. The Pitchfork Knight does not think highly of the Went's chance of buying back Harrenhal with a horse, but he lets them go anyway. As the riders leave, Sandor finally gives the Pitchfork Knight a name, Donal Hay, whose knightly ass Sandor has repeatedly dumped in the mud during tourneys. Arya wonders why the knight didn't recognize Sandor, and Sandor once again dusts off his mantra, because knights suck and are stupid. One more shot, everyone. Get blind stinking drunk just in time for the wedding. I think we're gonna need it. Fooling knights like Donal Hay is exactly why they have this wagon, and now we find out how that happened. Sandor stole it from a farmer, because ripping off the ferryman just wasn't enough to fulfill Sandor's highway robbery quota for this quarter.
I am almost there, Arya thought. She knew she ought to be excited, but her belly was all knotted up tight. Maybe that was just the fever she'd been fighting, but maybe not. Last night she'd had a bad dream, a terrible dream. She couldn't remember what she'd dreamed of now, but the feeling had lingered all day. If anything, it had only gotten stronger. Fear cuts deeper than swords. She had to be strong now, the way her father told her. There was nothing between her and her mother but a castle gate, a river, and an army. But it was Rob's army, so there was no real danger there.
Was there?
You bet there is, Arya, and she even knows where the danger is coming from.
Roose Bolton, the Leech Lord.
After all, Arya killed one of his guards to get away from Harrenhal. Then again, Arya thinks Roose probably won't recognize her, especially after Sandor gave her his patented half-bald haircut a couple days back. Arya thinks that Robin Catelyn might not even recognize her either. I'll just run around breaking shit, kid. They'll know who you are soon enough. They heard the music before they saw the castle. The distant rattle of drums, the brazen blare of horns, the thin skirling of pipes faint beneath the growl of the river, and the sound of rain beating on their heads.
We've missed the wedding, the hound said, but it sounds as though the feast is still going. I'll be rid of you soon.
No, I'll be rid of you, Arya thought. Sorry, folks, you're both wrong. Finally, the twins come into sight, along with the huge camp outside, with thousands of men hanging out in three large feast tents. Arya realizes that the musicians in the two castles are playing two different songs, so it sounds less like music and more like a battle. Huh, funny you should say that, Arya. I guess Bran's not the only Stark kid who can see the future. Arya just wishes it was daytime so she could get a good look at the banners in the camp, and find one she remembers from home. But as it stands, all the banners look gray. Well, sounds like the Stark color to me. What's the problem? Everyone's getting along. They come up against a perimeter wall made of wagons and carts. Unfortunately, the guard captain is a Bolton man, and even more unfortunately, he's smarter than Donal Hay was, which I guess is a pretty low bar. First, he points out that salt pork is no fit meal for a lord's wedding. Wow, so much salt pork slander in this chapter. Sandor says he's got pickled pig's feet too, which, fair point, that does sound better, but then the guard says that the castle's closed up. They can, however, feed the common soldiers, who I guess are just peasanty enough to eat salt pork. He tells Sandor to ask for Sedgkins, who I just picture as Porkins from Star Wars. I guess just all the pork talk is just making me think of him. The hound rides through the camp past all sorts of tents, the lordly ones with bright colors and embroidered designs, and the common tents, which are basically just canvas wrapped around a couple sticks. Arya twisted and turned, trying to look everywhere at once, hoping for a glimpse of a direwolf badge, for a tent done up in gray and white, for a face she knew from Winterfell. All she saw were strangers. She stared at a man relieving himself in the reeds, but he wasn't Alebelly. She saw a half-dressed girl burst from a tent laughing, but the tent was pale blue, not gray like she'd thought at first, and the man who went running after her wore a tree cat on his doublet, not a wolf. Beneath the tree, four archers were slipping waxed strings over the notches of their longbows, but they were not her father's archers. A maester crossed their path, but he was too young and thin to be Maester Lewin. Arya gazed up at the twins, their high tower windows glowing softly wherever a light was burning. Through the haze of rain, the castles looked spooky and mysterious, like something from one of old Nan's tales. But they weren't Winterfell. Now see, that's all the Starks needed. Two Winterfells. They wouldn't be in all this trouble if they had an emergency backup Winterfell. I mean, I guess that's what the Karr Starks are supposed to be, but well, that's not going great at the moment, to say the least. Arya glances into one of the big feast tents and sees hundreds of men getting wasted, singing songs and leading toasts, some to the bride and groom, and others to King Robb and someone named Queen Jane, who Arya's never heard of. The only queen she knows is Cersei. Setting the bar pretty low there, Jane on her worst day is a better queen than Cersei on her best. Arya recognizes some of these soldiers as Northmen and wants to stop, but Sandor, shockingly, says no.
"Your brother will be in the castle," he said. "Your mother, too. You want them or not?"
"Yes," she said. "What about Sedgkins?" The sergeant had told them to ask for Sedgkins.
"Sedgkins can bugger himself with a hot poker."
Clegane shook out his whip and sent it hissing through the soft rein to bite at a horse's flank.
"It's your bloody brother I want."
"No, not Sedgkins. We'll be asking for the rest of time. What happened to Sedgkins?" And that is the synopsis for A Storm of Swords, Arya 9 and 10. Two chapters in one. What did you think of them, Manu?
Whenever Sedgkins is not on screen, Arya should be asking, where is Sedgkins?
She'll never let it go.
I mean, this is it, right? Well, not it, but we're right there. It's Kat and Arya all the way down as we lead up to the event of this book, the event of the series so far. You can feel it in George's prose, right away with a rain like a thousand swords, giving heft to the book's title. But these chapters are deft in their own right. Every little obstacle, every flooded river upping Arya's anxieties ever so slightly, when she's so close, leaving an ominous dread in the reader. I hate to belabor the point, but it's not just the shock at the twins that makes all this hit so hard. It's the methodical buildup and periphery storylines that really make it stick.
Yeah, even before we get to the Red Wedding itself, these chapters mark a major shift in Arya's storyline. We've gone from her friendly little gang of orphans and guerrilla fighters to an odd couple driving each other crazy. We've gone from the wistful melancholy of characters like Beric and Thoros to the sarcastic misery of the Hound. We've gone from helping the small folk to ripping them off. The imagery changes to reflect that shift. Arya's last few chapters were so colorful. Beric's fiery sword, Lem's big yellow cloak, the ghost of Highheart's red eyes burning through the night. These chapters are written pretty much exclusively in shades of black and gray, externalizing Arya's depressive state of mind, and Sandor's as well. As with Catelyn V that we covered with Pat a couple episodes back, the natural world itself seems to sense the slaughter coming. These chapters feel like wandering a graveyard.
Arya 9 ends up being its own little adventure, focused on the details and minor logistics of her prisoner transfer at the hands of Sandor Clegane. Their destination is only revealed at chapter's end, so until then, we carry Arya's worst fears with us, that she's bound back for King's Landing to be thrown at the feet of Cersei and Joffrey, or into a black cell, or right to a chopping block. So George makes this chapter its own series of obstacles, some that she can overcome, like crossing the river, and some that she can't, like slipping free of the Hound. George does this with a deluge of imagery to open this chapter, a black iron sky unleashing a storm of swords, as I mentioned earlier. The rivers are pregnant, rumbling, as the flooded trees and shores give the appearance of drowning men. The way the rivers are described all through these chapters is akin to a dam, ready to burst, the waters are overfilled. The Red Wedding is that dam, a moment where that flow will be unleashed, wine and blood at the twins, and the narrative can flood forward from there once we pass that hinge of the narrative. My favorite bit is the river growling like a dog here, which at first blush plays perfectly against her captor of Sandor Clegane. But if we peek ahead to Arya 10, near the twins, Arya will say the river growls like a lion. The treachery at the Twins is a result of Lannister treachery informing that later simile, but here on the rivers is where Sandor's brother Gregor has been harrying the rearguard of Robb's armies.
At this point, Arya doesn't see the difference between a dog growling and a lion growling because she thinks the Hound still works for the lions. And that's the structure of this chapter. Arya trying to get inside Sandor's head, figure him out, which the reader is also doing because Sandor, unlike Arya, is not a POV character. We get hints as we go along. Arya thinks the river doesn't look like the Blackwater and that the moss is on the wrong side of the trees, but Arya's a little kid, she's not so good at orienteering that we necessarily take her word for it, so doesn't exactly give it away. Now, we saw Sandor abandon the Lannister cause during the Blackwater, but unlike the show, he didn't deliver his big, explicit fuck the king speech there. In the books, it happens here at the end of the chapter. So we go into this chapter unsure of Sandor's intentions. We do know he needs money, and it makes sense for Arya to assume that he's looking for a reward from the Lannisters, as Sandor himself admits he could probably get the most money from them. The twist that he's taking her to the Twins, the exact same place Beric and Thoros were planning on taking her, remakes the chapter on reread. The first time through, you're hoping the Brotherhood catches up to save Arya from the Lannisters. On reread, you can see the irony that Sandor isn't deliberately taking her into danger. No, he just does it accidentally. There's more to Sandor beneath the surface. That's the whole idea of his character. And so it makes sense for both Arya and the first-time reader to be wrong-footed about where we're actually going.
We zoom in on Sandor's burned arm from the trial here, still festering under its wrappings. The Hound's quote-unquote death at the end of A Storm of Swords is as much a result of the cumulative wounds he suffers during this book and through his life, as opposed to any single one, giving truth to the hard life of Sandor Clegane that the elder brother will speak to in A Feast for Crows. The hardest man you know is not going to go down like Boromir in Fellowship of the Ring. He's going to beg an 11-year-old girl to mercy kill him by yammering about how he should have assaulted her sister. The exact opposite of Boromir, even. This Arya and the Hound roadshow is a lot less talkative than we saw in the show. I think that can just be attributed to the show rightly giving more lines to Rory McCann and Maisie Williams, specifically given their stellar performances both individually and together as a duo, one they would circle back to in the show's endgame. The show ended up stretching out a lot of the Arya and Hound material to pace it with the rest of season 4, and while McCann plays a terrifying hound even when silent, that performance is best when he's allowed to run his mouth about how he's going to eat every fucking chicken in this fucking inn. But here in the books, the Hound is less forthcoming in speech, and basically tells Arya it's classified when she asks if the river ahead is the Blackwater Rush. I've been talking about all the similarities in the stretch of Storm chapters for several episodes now. Passing through ruined villages, retreading old ground, but there's also another connection across the book's second act, how disconnected everyone is from the larger goings-on in Westeros. Arya, Jaime, Bran, Jon, Sam, in one capacity or another, these characters have basically been in the wild for all of this book. While away from hubs of information, the political reality has changed and they will have to scramble to get back up to date, whether it's learning about Theon taking Winterfell, or Robb marrying Jaime, or Stannis failing at the Blackwater, or the mutiny at Craster's Keep. Arya asking, "Is this the Blackwater?" is a result of that. Arya's been so focused on her day-to-day survival since being captured by the other Clegane brother that she hasn't truly realized how much of that ground has shifted beneath her feet. Yet for all that, the clues were there for her, or at least for the reader. If Arya had engaged in Serio Farrell's true seeing during the trial by combat, or paid attention during Sandor's drunken stand-up routine, she perhaps could have picked out that Clegane was no longer in the good graces of the Lannisters, rather just another outlaw sword and broken man wandering the countryside. Another reason Book Sandor is not interested in chatting is that Arya won't shut up about Micah. As we discussed in Arya 6, the death of Micah acts as original sin for Arya, the day that Innocence, and Micah and Lady, died in one fell swoop. Honestly, and maybe I'm just doing a little Chloe propaganda here, but part of me thinks Sandor Clegane doesn't feel specifically great about butchering the butcher's boy himself. I don't think he's beating himself up over it. It was in the line of duty at the order of the Crown Prince. But all the same, as much as the Hound likes killing, I don't think Micah's kill is one of those sweeter memories. I do also want to give a quick shout out to Stranger, Clegane's heavy courser, who acts as a signposting for Sandor when we get to the Quiet Isle later on. But here, Stranger just reminds me of Gendry. No, not the character this time, but my cat, who really loves me and only me, and greets everyone else with hisses and bile.
As he should, he's got to keep you safe. And yeah, Stranger is Sandor's horse for sure. He's just as violent and aggressive as his master, but Stranger is gentle to Sandor, Arya thinks, and in turn, Sandor can be gentle as well. The problem is that it's impossible to separate his vulnerability from his violence, because violence is how he deals with his vulnerability. Sandor's bark is worse than his bite, but his bite is still pretty damn fierce, and his bark is enough on its own to make sure Arya stays hating him. It reminds me of Jaime, as we've said before. We can see the disconnect between Jaime's words and thoughts, but all Brienne has to go on are the words, so her attitude toward him doesn't change until his words and actions change. Sandor is like a non-POV version of Jaime, one you have to interpret more. First thing we learn about the Sandor-Arya relationship are the rules he gives her. Don't fight back, don't talk back, don't run. If you do, I'll tie your hands, he says. I'll bind your feet, I'll gag you, I'll throw you over my saddle like a sow for slaughter. Such violent imagery, it's preparing you to expect the worst. But then look at how Sandor reacts to Arya trying to kill him. Instead of yelling at her, his mouth just twitches like he's barely keeping himself from bursting into laughter. And why not? Arya probably looks pretty funny, this tiny little kid with her arms shaking as she holds up a rock bigger than her head. She's not a threat, and he doesn't treat her like one. He takes the rock away as if she were a baby, George writes. For Arya, that's an insult. As George also writes, she's more angry than scared. But for Sandor, that's being gentle. He's treating her like a helpless child. He only gets dangerous when she brings up Micah. Why don't you just kill me, like you killed him, like you killed that helpless child? That's when Sandor drags Arya close and threatens to beat her within an inch of her life. The violence covers up the vulnerability. Sandor clearly knows that killing Micah was a monstrous act, like you say, or why would he care? Why would he bother threatening Arya? Just let her say the name all day if it makes her happy. It matters to Sandor because, as we saw during his trial under the Hollow Hill, the murder of Micah totally undercuts his persona. Like I said when we covered that chapter with Reuben, Sandor cannot claim to be the one man in Westeros to call bullshit on the system, but also say it was okay for him to kill a defenseless kid because he was ordered to. Knights are for killing, he told Sansa, but so is he, despite not being a knight, and he can't stand that level of self-awareness because it reminds him he could choose to do differently. And yeah, they're totally agree. The reason we get a very different Arya-Sandor relationship on the show is that the medium has different needs. We're not dealing with flesh-and-blood actors who develop their own unique, maybe unexpected chemistry. And we also don't need as much banter because we have the POV structure, giving us Arya's thoughts and strategically concealing Sandor's. Again, there's a lot going on underneath. There is still a lot of humor in these chapters, but it's more situational than witty. Like the opening line of Arya 9, in which Sandor sees how high the river has risen and just starts swearing his ass off. The constant running joke here is the contrast between how Sandor sees himself and how he actually behaves. He sees himself as a badass truth-teller, a fearless man whose words and actions you have to take seriously. But here he is, getting his ass kicked by the rain, ripping off peasants just to prove he can. It's a very bleak comedy. Maybe not ha-ha funny.
So I think it's safe to say that we here on Nauticast, as well as most of our listeners, are A Song of Ice and Fire sickos.
Out and proud.
We have places and family trees written into our brain while being quick on the recall of the most minute and mundane facts from the story. As such, we really got to cherish those moments where we falter or struggle remembering something, which happened to me as I prepped for this episode. Who the fuck are Lord Root and Old King Andahar? Well, turns out no one really knows much about Andahar, whose only mention in any Westerosi set work is right here in Arya 9, A Storm of Swords. It's probably safe to presume he was some river king at some point or another, and the reader can feel free to assign some history to him, akin to what we heard about Tristopher the Fourth Mud in the previous Catelyn chapter. But another dead, nigh-forgotten monarch of the Riverlands once again hints at a potential fate for Robb's legacy following the Red Wedding. House Root is a minor house in Westeros, their sigil a two-headed horse like that on the raft Arya and the Hound will rent. This was likely taken from Andahar himself, as conquest often involves usurping or co-opting native traditions for the conqueror's sake. Often, this sort of cultural appropriation is used to create a sense of stability, showing a consistency from one regime to the next. Hey, the guys before you ruled under the banner of a two-headed horse, and we're happy to do the same. The preservation of ballet, for example, a historically aristocratic art form, from the old Tsarist Russia to the post-Bolshevik Revolution Russia, is a real-life example of this occurring. The roots otherwise exist in the background of A Song of Ice and Fire properly. Squire Lucas Root died in the War of the Five Kings, and Jaime will note that they have bent the knee to the Iron Throne in A Feast for Crows. Historically, Richard Root was one of the first round of Kingsguard Knights founded in 10 AC, and House Root does play a larger role in The Dance of Dragons on Rhaenyra's side, though Criston Cole and later Vhagar will lay ruin to Lord and Town in turn. And I guess it's worthwhile to note the name of Harroway Town, built off the root of Harrow, which is to cause distress or to aggrieve. Everything about the March to the Red Wedding is harrowing, and in a more martial sense, the Mountain's men are harrowing the rear of the Northmen march during this time.
Oh, that's a great catch. And yeah, great point about how many different names and histories are coming together here. You got Haraway's Town, Root's Castle, Andahar's Horse. Beneath every history, another history. Something George does really well in the Riverlands, especially because of how many people have conquered and crisscrossed the Riverlands on their way elsewhere. If you head farther north, where the Andals never took over, you'll find a similar pattern, but in a more magical, mystical sense. The land that once belonged to the Children of the Forest, and suffered through the Long Night. Here, the two-headed horse turns out to be something totally mundane. Just a boat, nothing more. But the two heads facing different directions still feels like a symbol of time. We look back and forward from the present moment, riding down the river of time, like Janus. And just like how every culture, every kingdom, every generation dies and gives way to the next one, this entire town is drowned beneath the rising river. As we've been saying, both the rivers and the rain increasingly stand in for the forces of death and time, sweeping everything else away.
Again, George has us focus in on the minor obstacles of this leg of the journey, with the first-time reader still unsure what Arya's destination is. The river itself is the main stumbling block, of course, but paying for passage is another hindrance in their path. The Hound says he's good for it, but Arya knows all the Hound has is some toilet paper the Brotherhood gave him. The price is 3 dragons, 1 for each rider and horse, and of course 3 dragons just has her mind flicked to Daenerys for the briefest moment. The Hound lies, invoking Knight's honor, a thing he doesn't believe exists, and a thing which he cannot swear to. But I'm sure his line, gold on the north bank or steel on the south, may have motivated the ferryman more than his non-existent chivalric oaths.
I think it might be a combination. The promise of gold, then he backs it up with the threat of steel, then he invokes honor so the ferryman can feel like a little less ripped off until they get there. It reminds me of Varys's riddle, you know, which of these things is really important to someone making a decision. And I think there really is no one answer. People believe in any and all of those at once.
Yeah, beneath the gold, the bitter steel, as the Golden
Exactly.
Company would say.
Mm-hmm.
In Arya 8, we discussed how Arya is going over worn ground, returning to familiar places as our narrative wraps itself around the pole that is the Red Wedding, giving it a cumulative feel. We get more of that here, but not in place, but in being. Arya is called a boy again, like she had been during the earliest parts of A Clash of Kings, when she felt the most helpless, hidden, and ignored. This helplessness is further played out by the italicized thoughts in Arya's mind, rejoinders and counters to Sandor Clegane's lies, but she knows if she speaks up, he will shut her up. Her agency is still not there. She's still completely at the whims of the men lording over her.
And even worse than being called a boy, as Arya thinks, is being taken for Sandor's son, specifically. She's wearing a disguise again, like he's pretending to be a knight. But it was one thing when Arya had to be Ari or Weasel or Nan, etc. She chose those names, those faces to wear like masks that she will do literally in the House of Black and White. Being treated like she's a Clegane is not something she chose, and it's unbearable for her. It feels like a betrayal of Ned and Catelyn. And it's all part of her getting tired of playing these roles and appearances as she gets closer temporarily to her family. Like she thinks about the man who might be Lord Root up in the tower. He doesn't look much like a lord, but then she didn't look much like a lady either. She can't tell anyone who she really is, even when they get closer to the twins. Arya just can't be herself. And all of this is leading to her giving up her identity, well, mostly when she gets to Braavos.
Rafting across the river acts as this chapter's set piece, a microscopic adventure in the long run, but no less harrowing, as at least one man is lost to the waters, and other dangers are just as nearly averted. George really zooms in on these travel logistics, firmly putting us into Arya's head as she lives through every crest and fall of the waves. It's basically all Arya and Kat show here until the Red Wedding, so being intimately locked into both characters' thoughts are a priority for George. Part of this, I think, also acts as a misdirect, similar to how Rob's battle plans in Cat 5 had. The author really emphasizes every danger on the road here, including being blown off course.
But for the moment, Arya doesn't know she's headed to the Twins. She thinks she's headed for torture and death at Joffrey's hands. Revenge for throwing his sword, in this very river, back in Book 1. As she thinks, drowning might be better than that, at least quicker. And I like that for a second, Arya thinks she might be able to swim for it, but quickly realizes she would stand no chance. She's smarter, it turns out, than Gelbert Glover, who almost got himself drowned trying to cross that river in Catelyn 5. So instead, she considers suicide. I've always been kind of nervous on boats, not because I'm, you know, rationally worried about capsizing. I know it's pretty safe. I know if it happens, it happens slowly. But part of me just looking over the side of a boat, a ferry, or any other kind of boat, it's just Part of me just wants to get it over with and jump in, like remove the dread and the possibility of it happening and just get it done. And that's what Arya's feeling here. It's a brutal irony on reread when you know she's not in danger from Joffrey, but also that if she knew what was waiting for her at the Twins, she might jump even quicker. Thankfully, Arya hesitates just long enough for the gods to interfere. The massive tree that comes hurtling their way makes me think of the old gods, embodied by the trees, like the one Sam saw recently north of the wall, or the one Jon dreamed of in his last chapter. Just like R'hllor wasn't done with Sandor Clegane during that duel beneath the Hollow Hill, the old gods are not done with Arya Stark. George also describes the trees looking like a kraken, bringing in the drowned god too. Just every god is teaming up to help out Arya here. If you think about it that way, though, it feels like the one boatman who dies was kind of a sacrifice. Like, he died so Arya would get spooked and not jump. It got too real for her. Death as an abstract concept is a lot easier to handle than someone slipping into their watery grave right in front of you. That's Arya's complicated relationship to death, which will only get deeper and weirder when she enters the House of Black and White.
Clegane pays the ferryman with the IOU Beric had given him. You can almost herald the birth of Westerosi capitalism here, as the Hound says the face value of the Brotherhood treasury bond is well above the new asking price of 6 dragons. The Hound chalks it up as a hard lesson to his ferryman. Knights have no bloody honor. Time you learned that. Which makes a nice comparison to Jaime Lannister, who is doing everything he can now to try and reclaim some honor after his shit turn as a Kingsguard. But the Hound isn't really here to give them a lesson in cultural norms. This all works as strategy to keep any pursuers off his back. Arya has spent as much time this chapter looking back for the Brotherhood as she had looking forward to her unknown destination. But the flooded rivers and now disgruntled and mistrusting ferrymen of Harroway Town are far less likely to give Beric and Thoros a ride over the rivers, and even that would have to wait until the next morning at this point.
Not only is Sandor literally cutting off Arya from the Brotherhood, he's rejecting them on a philosophical level as well. He's handing over the IOU that the Brotherhood gave him, but they were doing so in the name of helping the small folk suffering during the war. Here, Sandor has callously manipulated these men who risked their lives for him, and in one case lost their lives. This is arguably the central idea of Sandor's character arc. He has a very intimate understanding of the hypocrisy of the social order of Westeros, in which brute violence and exploitation are covered up with appeals to chivalry. He laid it all out to Sansa back in Book 1. I was playing with a little toy knight, the childhood foundation of ideology, like the Song of the Seven that Sam sang for Gilly and her baby. And then my big brother shoved my face into the flames, asserting his dominance over not only the toy, but also me. And there were no consequences for that. Gregor was knighted by the beloved Prince Rhaegar, whose wife and son were later brutally killed by Gregor, while Sandor wound up a child soldier for the Lannisters. So it's all a lie. That toy, my brother's knighthood, the entire system of vows and titles and pure white Kingsguard cloaks, all of it is bullshit. And he's right. Knights have no bloody honor. But neither does Sandor when he behaves like this. What separates Sandor from the Brotherhood is that he has no vision at this point of what an alternative world would look like. Beric and his followers are making war on that social order, in order to defend people who are being victimized by Gregor, among others. Sandor is recreating that social order in miniature, exploiting and mocking people who believe in it, taking advantage of their naivete. In their eyes, he becomes a monster like Gregor. And that's deliberate on his part. It's why he has that hound helm. If I become the monster, I don't have to be afraid. Again, like Jaime, what he was thinking about in his fever dream, no one can hurt me if I have a sword, no one can hurt me if I'm whole. Sandor is both violent and vulnerable. He's a victim and victimizer. He's stuck in this circular logic where he propagates the violence that was done to him in order to demonstrate that this is just how the world works, and anyone who thinks otherwise is a fool like he used to be. It's all captured in his burned face. On one hand, it demonstrates the hideous violence done to him. On the other hand, he uses it to scare people, to give credibility to the idea that he might hurt them. Am I a monster? Or the victim of a monster? Or both? Does my face say something about me? Or does it say more about Gregor?
Sandor finally gets into a chatty mood, going on about Sansa and Gregor and all the worst men in his brother's employ. The Hound is damn near tickled that the Mountain had captured Arya without knowing who she was. He'll be sure to tell Gregor that when he kills him. Arya is aghast that Sandor would want to kill his own family, but of course, killing family members is key to the story of Westeros. From Targaryens of old to the end of this book, where Son murders father on the shitter. Even the Red Wedding, with all the interconnected northern bloodlines that surely include House Bolton, and the Riverland bloodlines containing the blood of House Frey, you can expect that there is some familial murder happening there too, even if by accident.
And Sandor says that Arya's the same. She wants Sansa dead. I don't think that's actually true, but the point still comes through. For all that Arya desperately wants to get back to her family, her life at Winterfell was not perfect. There are things she still resents about it. What Sandor does is connect the dots between that lost domestic childhood and the kill list, reminding us that Arya is not just angry about her life since the war started. She was angry before that, too. Even Westeros at peace, united under King Robert in whose name the Brotherhood fights, there didn't seem to be a place for Arya underfoot. It's this outsider status that Sandor senses in her, and his arc in these Arya chapters is about the grudging respect he starts to feel for her on that basis. "At least you look in my face," he tells her. "I'll give you that, She-Wolf." That's his little nickname for her. It was Little Bird for Sansa and She-Wolf for Arya. It's the way he kind of captures their differences. And he knows all about that. He's called the Hound more often than Sandor, after all. Part of why he resents the lords and the knights is that they won't look at him. They won't look him in the face. They won't acknowledge the brutal violence undergirding their social order and all their precious protocols. Arya has the same frustrations, and Sandor senses that. If Sansa connected him to what he used to believe, representing an ideal he's afraid to invest himself in again, Arya for Sandor stands in for who he actually is, a mirror image of someone starting down the same cynical path in which you become the monster the world demands you to be. Sandor is a cautionary tale for Arya, showing her how easily she could cut herself off from the hopeful community embodied by the Brotherhood. But he's also here to teach her a lesson about surface appearances versus hidden complexities. When they talk about Gregor, Arya is forced to admit that however much she hates Sandor, his brother is significantly worse. And when Sandor brings the conversation back around to Micah, broaching the topic he forbid her from earlier, it comes coupled with his reminding the reader that he saved Sansa's life in the riot. Both of those things are true, because the monster and the heroic true knight can be the same person. They're both masks that anyone can wear. Arya rejects that, saying that Sandor's lying. Which he is, in the sense that when he says Sansa sang for him, he is leaving out the whole knife at her throat part. But even that decision is telling. Like how Sansa remembers him giving her a kiss, even though George has confirmed that didn't actually happen. Even as Sandor claims to be telling it like it is, delivering the hard truths no one else is willing to confess, he is still romanticizing the past. But he's right that Arya is nourishing hatred. She's using it as her reason to keep going, and that is leading her to make some false assumptions, including where he's taking her.
The Hound finally comes forward with the endpoint on their Google Maps route. It's the Twins, not King's Landing. In this long, bleak stretch of material, this chapter ends on a quote-unquote win of sorts, or rather a hope. Bran and Jon just missed each other at Queen's Crown, and that's as close as two disparate Starks had been to each other in some time. The prospect of Arya reuniting with her mother and brother is tantalizing to the reader, likely at this point keeping them turning the page until the big celebration at the crossing. And the Hound gives a nod to the Redditors at the end of this chapter, offering a scintillating alternate universe where Sandor Clegane enters the service of the King in the North as he prepares to retake the North. Give me that storyline, please. Flipping over to Arya 10 now, this is a really short chapter. Deliberately so, I'd wager. Cat 6, Arya 10, Cat 7, and Arya 11 are the four consecutive chapters that cover the wedding at the Twins and ensuing butchery. The Cat chapters, especially Cat 6, which we'll touch next time, are longer by necessity. Catelyn is our eyes on Robb, Walder Frey, Roose Bolton, all the main players of the event, and the last inner workings of the betrayal are laid therein. The Arya chapters are much shorter, almost by half. These sudden jumps back in and out of Arya help build that suspense, help pace this event so that it keeps us on the edge of our seat, and in just my opinion, makes it more likely that the reader will plow through these 4 to 5 chapters all in one go. They work better in concert. tension and buildup as we yearn for Arya to reunite with her family, for Robb and Kat to be away from these odious Freys and march back home. The literal last words of Kat 6, as we'll get to. The pacing here is essential to the devastation felt, which sometimes can get lost in large books with many long chapters that jump all over around the world. Here, George is at his most efficient, knowing less is more, that a lot of the emotion is already set up by the 2.5 books of buildup. Now he's just got to lead the lamb to the slaughter, be that Robb Stark or the reader's heart. Arya, Sandor, and even Stranger are browsing incognito mode to start Arya 10, in disguise as they hope to make their way through the reverie straight to Robb and Catelyn. They had pillaged their costumes and cargo from a farmer on the road, and anyone blessed with Cyrio Pharrell's true seeing would probably note something amiss given the hound's gigantic stature as a farmer and his mean courser. This chapter is a great little showcase for Sandor Clegane, perhaps George's best realized non-point-of-view character this side of Stannis Baratheon. We know him well enough at this point, primarily through the eyes of the two Stark daughters. He's been mostly a physical, violent force in the story, sometimes for good, such as the Hand's Tourney defending Loras or saving Sansa as he said, and sometimes for ill, pretty much all other service to the Lannisters, and often somewhere in between. But this chapter shows that Sandor Clegane knows how to use his noggin, building off some of his sharper tactics in eluding the Brotherhood last chapter. He knows to keep his head down and to malord and malady the guards to death, using the proper small folk intonation. His cover for Stranger is as a gift from Lady Went, who, to be honest, we don't actually know if she's alive or dead right now. She's mentioned little after being dispossessed of Harrenhal at the end of A Game of Thrones, and Littlefinger will tell Sansa that Lady Went died in A Feast for Crows. Either way, it's a sensible lie. But most of all, it's the fact that knights are fools that Clegane bets on, that looking too closely at peasants is something beneath them. Keep your face down and spout your courtesies, and even people who know you like this Sir Donald Hay will not remember the giant who had beat him many times in tourney. Clegane here reminds me a lot of Cassian Andor from Andor, when rebel leader Luthen Rael is incredulous that Cassian had just walked in and stolen an Imperial Starpath from a naval base. To quote Cass, "You just walk in like you belong. What do you need? A uniform? Some dirty hands? An Imperial toolkit?" They're so proud of themselves, they don't even care. They're so fat and satisfied, they can't even imagine it, that someone like me would ever get inside their house, walk their floors, spit in their food, take their gear. This is very much in line with systems of powers and stratified class structures, where one group of people is considered elite, more honorable, better than the rest. Such systems reinforce themselves by creating an attitude that anyone beneath you on the organizational chart is literally not worth your time or attention. Sandor Clegane understands this contradiction better than most, having served for the highest people of the land, witnessing their utter disregard for the small folk, mostly ignoring them but also just being ordered to kill them on command, and while he himself doesn't hold any titles or class signifiers himself. He knows the ruling elite care more about wealth and property than the poor, as evidenced by the attention paid to Clegane's horse and almost none to Sandor or Arya themselves. While Sandor knows how to use class prejudices to his advantage, he's not without a certain pride of his own. He will not be supplicating himself to the King of the North as a prisoner or fight his way in by sheer will, which would be a tall task even for him. He wants to present Arya to Robb and Catelyn face to face in order to get his reward or new assignment or whatever the Starks have in store for him.
Which, I gotta say, even by broken man standards, this is a really bad plan. How is this actually going to work? Like, even if Sandor got Arya into the castle and no Red Wedding was happening, what's he gonna do? Hello, your grace, 'tis I, the notorious killer who's been working for your enemy since childhood. Don't worry, though, I'm totally not doing that anymore, and I brought you your little sister back. If she says something about me kidnapping her, don't listen. That's just a little joke we tell. Anyway, gold, please. I think Sandor is right that Robb probably wouldn't just kill him on the spot, but nor do I think Robb would pay, not even with one of Beric's IOUs. It speaks to Sandor's desperate position that he's even considering this. His brother Gregor holds the Clegane castle and lands, and Sandor will never again be welcome there. He's abandoned the Lannister service along with the Kingsguard cloak he briefly wore for them. Why not join the Night's Watch or some sellsword company? Well, as Septim Narrable tells us, the broken man thinks no further than his next drink. Sandor didn't really have a plan with all that gold he won at the Hand's Tourney back in Book 1. I mean, the plan was step 1, drink, step 2, there is no step 2. We've gone from the idealized outlaws of the Brotherhood, who would only accept a ransom for Arya in order to buy food for the small folk, to the more cynical version of an outlaw in Sandor, who was only out for himself. And not even that, Sandor isn't even taking care of himself. All he wants is oblivion, to not have to think or face himself or the world anymore. And once again, as at the river, he's willing to rip off the small folk in order to get his sweet, sweet booze. Think back to Sandor's trial under the Hollow Hill, when he mocked the Brotherhood's pretensions of knighthood, saying they were more swineherds than soldiers. Well, one of the Brotherhood said some of them were swineherds, but the war made them soldiers and knights, put them through a crucible like with Beric. Now with Sandor, we're seeing the opposite, a soldier pretending to be a swineherd, using a peasant disguise to fool a knight. Where Beric was earnest and authentic, Sandor is pure cynicism, taking advantage of the lower classes in order to poke holes in the upper ones. It's so telling when Sandor is robbing that poor guy and says he's just foraging. That's how the Lannisters described the bloody work being done by the likes of Gregor and Aemery Lorch, before he got ripped to pieces, that is. It's that kind of euphemism that Sandor despises about the courtly world of Westeros, those memorized mantras he made fun of Sansa for repeating. Lem threw it in Sandor's face when the Brotherhood took his gold. You're not being robbed, you're being foraged. Even as Sandor mocks this pretense, he's still using it. Self-aware highway robbery is still highway robbery. It's this closed loop of violence begetting violence. The only disruptions for Sandor comes in relation to the Stark girls, which we'll see again when Sandor saves Arya's life at the Twins by hitting her in the head with an axe.
The closer Arya gets to the Twins, the more her stomach turns. She feels sick. She's almost there, but the vibes are totally off. Something isn't right, and I feel that comes through in George's writing too. Arya had a bad dream last night, but unlike literally every other instance in A Song of Ice and Fire, we don't actually see this dream. No last-minute foreshadowing or visions or Bloodraven fuckery or what have you. We are well past the event horizon of the Red Wedding. It's just bad vibes and bad blood all the way down. No dreams or visions doesn't mean the buildup stops, though. Arya's mind jumps right to Roose Bolton, who will be taking center stage in pink during the next two Catelyn chapters. She fled him as much as she fled the Lannisters and Mummers, and the worry that he will remember her pains Arya just as much as her brother and mother not remembering her does.
That's a great comparison. I never thought of that before, that she's so worried about whether Robb and Catelyn will know her, but by the same token, she worries that Roose might be able to recognize her. And, you know, maybe logically that doesn't make sense, but it's just Arya's got those self-esteem issues and just this anxiety from not being able to get what she wants, for, you know, Yoren not being able to get her home, Beric not being able to get her home. Why is Sandor going to be able to get the job done? And this is a great example of how you can set something up and distract your audience from it at the same time. Like, yeah, we should be afraid of Roose Bolton, but not because he'll recognize Arya. And she's thinking about Roose mostly to try and explain her own feelings to herself, to justify with something rational about why she's so suddenly full of dread. That dream she had is a prophecy that comes too late to help her. On the other side of the Red Wedding, Bran tells us he had a similar dream, or so we can only guess, because like Arya, Bran never describes his dream. This is too terrible to face directly with your conscious mind. George is framing the Red Wedding as the return of the repressed. On both a personal and political level, it represents hidden forces breaking the surface.
Music reaches Arya's ears long before the castle meets her eyes. The distant rattle of drums making me think of Fellowship of the Ring and the drums in the Deep of Moria. The music will add a rhythm and connective tissue to the subsequent cat chapter, which we'll get to in a couple episodes. But it's not just that the music is already playing. It's already bad beyond compare. George's descriptions of rattles, brazen blares, and thin skirlings let the reader know it's not all that good before Arya says as much. It sounded more like a battle than a song, as one of those things that exists in the liminal space of foreshadowing and the present upon reread. Are the first bits of the fighting outside begun yet? Not yet, but not yet overtaken the entire camp? Arya laments the nighttime, obscuring what's happening, obscuring the banners that could point her towards friendly faces. When Jaime wrote for Harrenhal to save Brienne, I said I didn't even need to state what Vargo Hoat's banner hanging lip high above meant. Surely the same applies here with the northern banners Arya is so eager to identify but can't because they are also hanging limp. The rereader is going to start to see the warning signs right away as they near the castle. A hedge of wagons creates a barricade to prevent attack from without, Arya thinks. In actuality, it's to keep the northern forces within, preventing any mass exodus from the slaughter. With what's about to go down, the Boltons and Freys are not going to want loose stragglers leaving the crossing with the truth. The Bolton guards at the barricade are just another added layer to this defense. George hits us with the river growling like a lion simile I mentioned earlier, providing a low bass to accompany the musical arrangement of clashing cups and steel, laughs and curses and barks and whinnying. And everywhere Arya sees death. Or rather, she sees no familiar faces, only strangers. Stranger, of course, being part of the A Song of Ice and Fire nomenclature for death. Even the twins remind Arya of a spooky castle from old Nan's tales, and we all know Nan's tales veer hard into the dark side.
The descriptions of tents lit up from within like magic lanterns also creates that storytime atmosphere, and it reminds me of how Renly's camp is described right before his death. We are about to see another king get taken off the game board. The difference is our perspective on it. Our POV in Renly's camp was Catelyn, an outsider to the Renly versus Stannis feud. Our POV here is Arya, who wants to be an insider, ought to be an insider, her brother is the king. But she doesn't feel like one. That great passage where she doesn't recognize anyone is partially setting up the slaughter about to take place, in that these are no longer her brother's men. They're about to reveal themselves as his enemies. They're unrecognizable in the sense that they're not who the Starks think they are, just like how Arya and Sandor in disguise, these men are about to turn into beasts. But this also expresses Arya's alienation from the world around her. How nothing and nowhere feels like home to her anymore. She can't get back the life she used to live. Everything has changed, and her childhood at Winterfell is gone. She doesn't even know who this Queen Jane is that everyone's toasting. It's the horrible feeling of something she's wanted so much slipping right through her fingers. I had that same feeling towards the end of a Twin Peaks The Return when Dale Cooper manages to travel back through time to save Laura Palmer and then just loses her hand in the woods, and it all falls apart. Like they say in that show, we live inside a dream, and Arya's bad dream from the other night is about to come true. So, shifting into foreshadowing and groundwork, obviously, so much of these chapters are foreshadowing and groundwork for the Red Wedding. But even beyond that, we do learn in the epilogue to A Storm of Swords from Merit Frey's perspective that the Brotherhood was indeed trying to track down Arya and Sandor. And they even found all the various presents Sandor robbed on his way north. So they got across the river eventually, but then the trail went cold. But, hey, at least they found Catelyn's body along the way, thankfully, I guess.
I love it as, like, the most fucked up version of Hansel and Gretel, but instead of leaving breadcrumbs, it's just people that the Hound robbed along the way.
You look like you got fucked up by Sandor Clegane. You got a story to tell?
We're on the right path.
Exactly. There's that great bit where Thomas Sevens, when they're about to hang Merit Frey, and Thomas Sevens says, look, I'll tell them to let you go if you tell me if Sandor was at the Twins. And Merit's like, I don't know, I didn't see him. And Tom's like, all right, too bad, up you go. And Merit says, you said you'd let me go. And Tom says, no, I said I'd tell them to let you go. Lem let him go. And Lem just says, fuck yourself, and starts hanging Merit. And Tom just goes, oh, well, shrugs and starts playing a song. Great and brutal, again, bleak comedy in the Riverlands in this book. So moving into theory and discussion, like you mentioned earlier, we mostly see Sandor Clegane through the eyes of the Stark sisters, through Sansa's eyes in the first two books, and now Arya's eyes in Storm of Swords, and it's very different dynamics. So which do you think is more interesting or more well done, Sandor's dynamic with Sansa or his dynamic with Arya?
Well, I think first of all, for our listeners, I will say Chloe is not holding a gun to Emmett's head, so he is able to answer of his own free
will metaphorically.
When he gets to it.
Only internally. Mm-hmm.
It's hard not to be colored by the show just because, like we've talked about, Maisie and Rory just had so much more time together and some really stellar scenes. But I think in the books, I really do go for Sandor and Sansa. And I think a lot of that is just because it's a lot messier when you start talking about the unkiss or the song that he got at knife point out of Sansa. It's just I don't know, I just love mess, and I just like how complex that relationship is. And that's one, I know up top of this episode, we talked about whether Arya and the Hound would get some kind of farewell together. I would definitely be a little more invested in Sansa and the Hound crossing paths at some point down the road.
Yeah, I think the Sandor-Sansa relationship is more interesting as a concept. I think the Sandor-Arya dynamic makes more kind of structural sense than both being on the road. Sandor and Sansa just kind of seem swept up together. And I think you could tell Sansa's storyline in A Clash of Kings without Sandor. I just think it would be a lot lesser for it. Whereas Arya kind of does structurally need Sandor as someone to get her to the Twins and then someone to leave behind for Braavos. And I think you can see, you see why the show expanded on it like it did, not only because of the chemistry of the actors, but because it's a very easy dynamic to express and get across, the rambunctious little kid, the sullen little kid, and this older, the gruff man who's not used to looking after a kid, perfect babysitter story material, easy to pitch. Sandor and Sansa, it's more complicated because it's Sandor looks at Sansa as kind of the opposite of him, but also an idealized version of the things he believed in, and he's kind of romantically interested in her, but also just kind of looks at her as the kind of person he'd want to chastely protect, and he's not sure what he wants out of it, and she's not sure what she thinks of him. It's messy, like you say, and it's like that on purpose because it's part of Sansa's development, and I think it reflects how she's at a different period of life than Arya because she's going through puberty and she feels herself kind of growing up more concretely than Arya does. And I think Sandor becomes a different kind of character for her because of that. Whereas Arya and Sandor's relationship to violence is kind of much more straightforwardly the focus. So I think, like we were saying up top, I do think Arya makes sense as a way to get Sandor back into the story. Again, there's the structural connection, but yeah, philosophically, in terms of the writing, I would be more interested in a Sandor-Sansa reunion. I think that could be really powerful.
Yeah, I think they're like, it's part of the fact that they're just kind of opposites in many ways. It's kind of the mm-hmm. same as the Jaime and Brienne, like how they're so kind of polar in their terms of personality and
yes.
kind of what they believe in. It is, I guess, Guardians of the Galaxy month in the world since the third one came out. And in the second Guardians of the Galaxy movie, there's this great scene between Michael Rooker's Yondu and Bradley Cooper's Rocket Raccoon, where Yondu just says, "I know who you are. You are me." And that's kind of what Arya and the Hound is. It's just like Arya is kind of like the Hound writ small, like, 9 years before she got her face thrown into the fire or something like that. You can see a storyline where Arya grows up to be the Hound or someone vicious like the Hound, whereas Sansa and the Hound, there's such a like tension because they're two such polar opposites, and I think the friction between those two is kind of a little meatier from my point of view.
Agreed, and I think that's part of what makes Sandor an interesting character, is that he's a lens through which you can see how different the Starks are, but also what they have in common is that they're both interested in this person and both kind of find him, obviously frustrating and terrifying and enraging in many ways, but also compelling in a way that they can't quite quit him, can't quite get rid of him. So having their reunion happen in the context if he's around, I think would also be interesting, as we've talked about before. So that is going to wrap us up for A Storm of Swords, Arya 9 and 10. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review on your podcast app of choice, we really appreciate that. It helps people find us. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get early access, exclusive episodes, and more benefits. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, or shoot us an email at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, @gmail.com, and you can find me at PoorQuentin on Twitter.
And I'm Manu at ManuClearBomb.
So, my latest Lord of the Rings episode for patrons is up for all of our $5 and above patrons, covering Book 6, Chapter 4, The Field of Cormallen, the chapter after the end of the world. That's up now. Our next Star Wars episode is going to be out for our $5 and above patrons next week. We're going to be doing that one together, kicking off the original trilogy, kicking off A New Hope together. And next up in A Song of Ice and Fire, we're going to be doing A Storm of Swords, Catelyn 6, proceeding on with Red Wedding Month, A Storm of Swords, Catelyn 6, in which Rob and his followers finally arrive at the Twins for Edmure's wedding. Always nice to get out of the rain, have a snack, and, just relax a little bit before everyone you know is murdered in front of you.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask for a premature apology because I'm going to talk about how fucking funny Walder Frey is in that chapter.
He really is. We only see Walder Frey in like 3 chapters total, but he's so distinct and memorable because everything he says is just so beautifully, perfectly awful. And we will be joined by a guest for that, a special guest, Queer Alex, who we've had on the podcast before, will be joining us for Storm of Swords, Catelyn 6. So glad to have them. That's going to be a great time. So we will see you right back here in 2 weeks for A Storm of Swords, Catelyn 6.